Well, we are talking about dirty futures, dirty past, dirt, the erosion of civilizations. David R. Montgomery, Dr. Montgomery, coming up in just a second. We'll be talking about how he reads our soil now. What do past failed civilizations tell us about our future? Just how much do we need to know about our dirt? So we'll get the dirt on our soil, I guess, coming up here in just a minute. As long as we were talking about the news, though, I have some sad news. Many of you have come out, I think, over time to catch me preaching and been kind enough to say something after a service. Very likely, if any time in the last couple of years you've come to the church where I work in Minnetonka, Minnesota, you would have heard the work of Anna Leno, who was our church organist and a delightful young woman. She graduated not even a year ago from Luther Seminary, where she was studying sacred music. She lost the battle with some demons, and we lost her. Those inner voices that say whatever they tell us in our darkest moments. And it's so sad to lose her. I'm thinking about her all night already, and I can't tell you more because I don't know more, but it's always a reminder to me that we should take seriously when people are going through bad spells, and to always try to do the most that we can for them. And sometimes even when you do the most that you can for them, like it's in this case, sometimes bad things still happen. So thoughts are with her and with her family and all that, all the people that knew her and had a chance to experience the great joy that she could bring to a keyboard and had the fastest feet on those pedals. I would sit there sometimes up at the altar and just couldn't take my eyes off her feet moving around. Sorry to lose her. And all the more reason for us, I think, to celebrate the life that we do have and to look for a better future. And speaking of feet, underneath our feet right now is our future. At least according to DIRT, the erosion of civilizations. What do we need to know next on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Coming up tomorrow on the first hour on Coast to Coast AM in honor of Friday the 13th, the most popular of the actors who play Jason will join us for a few minutes during the news segment. If you missed the news segment last hour, it's up on our blog at coasttocoastam.com, in which we talk a little bit about erosion, or at least in theory anyway, dirt, the erosion of civilizations. And good evening, Dr. David Montgomery. How are you?
Good evening, Ian. Fine. I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Well, first of all, you're an excellent writer. Love those. It's the most fun book I ever read on soil. It's fabulous.
Oh, thank you. What can I say?
It's like the perfect storm of soil books. I mean, I just wouldn't like a page turner, and it's all on dirt. And what's so interesting about it too is that these are things which I think we all just, well, at least probably not you, but just about everybody sort of takes for granted that the earth has got a nice big fat layer of soil, and it's always going to be there, and we're always going to be able to grow stuff in it. And in the end, we'll all just be fine. But that's really not the record of history, is it?
No, it really isn't. But most people really do have this conception that, you know, the earth is solid. All our metaphors for, the solid earth, the ground beneath our feet, all that kind of stuff, would lead us to kind of think of the world as always sort of been the way it is. But I'm a geologist by training, and so we're trained to think of how topography and soils are formed and shaped and lost over time. And when you take a geological perspective on it, you have a whole different set of glasses to look at the ground beneath your feet.
All right. Now, you're a geologist. You're a professor at University of Washington. First of all, do we need to parse the difference between the word dirt and soil, just for the record? Right?
We probably should, or there's going to be a whole lot of soil scientists that are going to be even madder at me than they are now.
Right. Because, I mean, dirt can be a lot of things other than soil.
Yeah, you could think of dirt in a simple definition as it's soil that's out of place. You know, if it gets on your clothes, it's dirt. If it's no longer on a farmer's field and it's a place where we don't really want it, then soil can become dirt. And you know, one of the reasons I chose the title as dirt was to try and, through the book, make the point to people that good soil isn't just dirt.
Right.
It's a mix of fertile, the minerals that make soils fertile, and also the life, the microbes, the worms, all of the life that makes soil fertile, the organic matter, and it's that mix of the living and the no longer living, and the bits of the earth itself, the broken down bits of rock that together make good soil.
Well, I think dirt is a great name for a book. Don't get me wrong, too. Soil just doesn't have the same ring to it, you know. And if it was called Soiled, you'd expect like a picture of, I don't know, Lindsay Lohan or somebody on the cover. You know what I mean? It's not, you got the right idea with dirt. I think it's important to point that out because we really are talking about not just like grime and, you know, the silt that exists on our unclean windowsills, but it's really the stuff that we're going to have to depend on for the future and the stuff that other civilizations took for granted that they would always have to depend on for their future.
That's right. It's that you could think of soil as essentially the thin skin of the earth that allows plants to sort of fix sunlight and during photosynthesis to make the organic matter that then the rest of us eat.
Right.
And they rely on soil to actually catalyze that process. And so you can think of it quite literally as the sort of the living skin of the earth that is the foundation for all life on the continents, and we fundamentally depend on it, yet we take it for granted, and as the lessons of prior civilizations have shown, we can, in fact, run out of it, even though it happens very slowly. In fact, so slowly it can be hard to stop, ironically
all right.
enough.
Well, how thin a layer of dirty epidermis are we talking about? I mean, really, around the Earth, at its thinnest and at its thickest?
Well, you know, at its thinnest, it can be no more than like a few inches or sort of like a almost, you know, a crusty pavement of some desert regions. There's just not much in some places. And in other places, I've been in sort of flat parts of the Amazon where there could be, you know, a 300-foot thick pile of rotten, weathered rock that's had so much alteration and so much stripped out of it that it's been reduced down to the iron and aluminum, and it becomes sort of aluminum ore. Sort of old soils are where we get our aluminum. And so soils are really, really diverse. There's thousands of different kinds and different kind of places on the planet. But if you look at an average, sort of averaged over the whole planet, you know, how thick is the average hill slope soil? It's anywhere from, you know, a foot and a half to 3 feet. It's not very thin. I'm sorry, it's not very thick. It's thinner proportionately to the size of the planet than our skin is to our bodies.
How are we doing in the United States on average for the thickness of soil?
Oh, boy, you know, I haven't seen a figure that breaks it out strictly by the U.S. in terms of its thickness, but I'd say we're probably average for, there's two different kinds of areas in the U.S. There's the areas that are outside of the loess belts of the Midwest, and what the loess is it's wind-deposited soil that was quite literally the stuff that glaciers scraped off of Canada during the last ice age, pushed down, you know, bulldozed down to the south, and then it blew around in the high winds on the near the front of the glacier system and redeposited the soils of the Midwest, the thick, really nice loess soils that make it such a great agricultural region. In those areas, some of the loess can be quite thick, you know, anywhere from a few feet to hundreds of feet thick and more, if I recall. But outside those areas, you know, we had that sort of average of a few feet of soil. But in different places, like the Southeast, we lost a lot of it historically to colonial agriculture. And if you look at the U.S. on average, and indeed sort of globally on average, in agricultural, off of agricultural fields, we lose an average of about a millimeter of soil a year, which sounds really slow until you realize that, you know, that actually adds up, but it adds up over centuries, not years.
Okay. So, and this is, again, these are just, I'm trying to sort of establish the where we stand with this. Like, compare the soil thickness that we have, or the, for that matter, the soil quality we have in the United States with, say, Greece or Egypt or some of the other, you know, famous empires of the past.
Well, if you look at a lot of the areas of sort of the Middle East, like Greece and Lebanon and places, a lot of the areas that are mentioned in the Old Testament, the soil was literally stripped off a couple thousand years ago. And so we're way ahead of them in terms of having much thicker soil left in the on our continent. But in many ways, we're actually following some of the similar steps that led them to lose theirs.
And that's the idea of trying to support a large amount of population growth on an increasingly smaller amount of arable land.
Yeah, that's essentially the fundamental problem that societies that don't take care of their soil face in the end. Because, you know, through farming practices, we essentially are able to feed large numbers of people with small numbers of farmers, particularly today. But if we, in so doing, we lose soil faster than it's reformed, then what we have are two curves: a rising population curve because we're producing so much food, but then a declining soil fertility curve because we're gradually mining and stripping off the soil. If those two curves intersect, it's not a good thing, obviously. And so the fundamental challenge, if you view what it takes to sustain a civilization over the long run, is how do you actually manage to feed large numbers of people on a shrinking land base or shrinking soil fertility base? And the answer is that as long as those two things are true, the population's rising and so the amount of arable land you have is declining, then the only way to do it is to continuously jack up agricultural productivity.
Right. And fortunately, that means that we just use more chemicals. What's wrong with that? I mean, that's something that the ancient Egyptians didn't have that we've got is better living through chemistry, right? Isn't that the answer?
Was the answer in the last half of the 20th century, and it's greatly responsible for both the tremendous population increase in the last half of the 20th century and our ability to actually feed the people that that arrived. And so the problem really arises not so much from the fact that we can use chemical supplements, fertilizers, to enhance agricultural productivity. It's what that does over the long run. And there's two trends that are particularly troublesome in thinking that way that could lead one back to, well, is it really all that wise to experiment with better living through chemistry on a global scale? And those problems are that, A, the production of nitrogen-based fertilizers depends on turning atmospheric nitrogen into ammonia. And atmospheric nitrogen is it's a pretty hard molecule to crack. It takes a lot of energy to do it. So we use a lot of energy to essentially produce the nitrogen-based fertilizers that allow us to have the very productive industrial agriculture that doesn't depend on native soil fertility, that depends on better living through chemistry. What's going to happen in the next, say, century as energy supplies become more expensive? We all saw in the last couple years how energy prices can really go through the roof. They've come back down now, but in a way that's a bit unfortunate because it's a direct response of the economic collapse.
Right.
But the lesson of the last couple of years is that I think we can expect energy prices to continue to go through the roof for the remainder of our lives, with blips. The brutal truth is we need to find either some really new, really cheap source of energy to continue making fertilizers, or it's going to become eventually relatively prohibitive to use oil to make fertilizers to feed ourselves, because right now we're basically eating oil.
Right, we have petroleum-based fertilizers. Let me back up for a second, and we'll get back onto this because I think this takes us into the future area, and so much of your book is about the past and how what we can learn from these civilizations that have come before us whose soil is the most interesting in history for you?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I could give you two answers to that. The first one has got to be my wife's soil in the garden because it feeds me in the summer.
Yeah. Okay. All right. But happy Valentine's Day, honey, if you're listening. Okay, now, who else is?
You know, I think that the thing that fascinated me most in doing the research for the book was two things, both the role of soil and its exhaustion in the sort of expansion and collapse of the Roman Empire, but also in the way that it influenced the American drive west. Because right. I think those are two sort of historical arenas in which, you know, a lot of people know a lot. There's a lot of Civil War buffs in the country. There's a lot of people who are fascinated with Roman history. And I don't think a lot of people fully appreciate how much the way that those societies treated their land in the end shaped their history. And to me, it was fascinating to learn about that, because as a geologist, you don't get taught that in geology school. You get taught about rocks and soil and water. And the way that it interacts with human societies is something that I really came to learn by doing the background research for the book. So
yeah,
I could cheat a bit and give you two answers.
Well, but there are not a lot of soil reenactors out there. So let's let's go ahead and let's go back to the Civil War, though, and give us that broad picture. What do you mean by that? That this is where, you know, people who got their, you know, 40 acres or 50 acres, whatever they were going to try to sustain their families on, you know, picked out a piece of land and farmed it, right? I mean, is it any more complicated than that?
Well, yeah. If you look at colonial agriculture in the Southeast from sort of the earliest days of the English colonies in America, the thing that allowed them to prosper was growing tobacco. Because they were, when they got to Virginia, for example, they tried all kinds of things to turn a profit. They were an economic colony. They were supported by investors. They needed to make money for folks back in London. And the way that it turned out they were able to do that was by growing tobacco, because tobacco was a crop that you could ship back to Britain. The Europeans were just starting to get addicted to tobacco, and the Spanish had a monopoly on tobacco production in the Caribbean. And so when the English crown realized they could grow their own tobacco in Virginia and then tax it and pocket the proceeds, they basically ran their empire off of tobacco money for decades. And so there was a great incentive for expanding tobacco cultivation in the early colonies. And the problem with tobacco over the long run is that it was a very erosive crop. It depleted soil fertility really fast, sucked the nutrients right out of the soil, and it also, the way it was grown, you lost the soil itself because the land was left sort of bare. You'd till the land up and then pile the dirt up around, the soil up around each individual plant. And if you've been in the Southeast during a good rainstorm, it can really rain there. And if the ground is bare and open to the sky, in effect, during a big rainstorm, you can strip off a lot of soil really fast. And so what happened is they found that they could get about 4 or 5 years of a productive crop out of a new piece of land before they didn't get such good returns on tobacco and it wasn't as productive. But they could just go next door, clear a new field. And they essentially, to make a long story fairly simple, they kept clearing, moving inland. As the quality of their land on the coast was exhausted, they kept moving westward. And eventually that fed back to the size of plantations. You needed a lot of land to actually maintain a tobacco farm over time. And that had implications that influenced the run-up to the Civil War.
Okay. Let's hold on to that, and we'll get back to it, too. Dirt, the erosion of civilizations. David Montgomery, a professor at University of Washington. We'll talk, too, about how wars were shaped around dirt and around what famous movements in history, for example, even just the movement to the New World, was all shaped by a need for soil. What was happening, what we've done wrong in the past, what we need to do to avoid having our story be one that spoke about a country with once fertile land that's now gone. We'll talk about that with Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, that's Professor Montgomery's band, Big Dirt. And we'll play some bumpers from that band, too. You can find out more about him and all his stuff by linking up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Dirt, the erosion of civilizations. Back to this conversation next. We'll talk about how the whole, you know, empires have been brought down by the quality of their soil and how we can keep that from happening to us next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Talking about dirt, the erosion of civilizations. Dr. Montgomery, is that the first time you've ever heard your band played on the radio?
No, but it never hurts. I always enjoy it. Thank you.
Okay. And are there other professors in Big Dirt? Is that like a thing in the science department? Is that like a science department band?
No. I'm the only physical scientist in it. We have a new lead vocalist who is a graduate student in psychology, and our drummer drives for a living, and our bass player owns a recording studio.
Wow.
So I'm the only academic, so I get to blow all the hot air in the band.
Well, I think so. So, I think this is cool. My wife does a little gardening, too, and I guess part of me comes to this conversation through watching her struggle sometimes just to get something to grow in a side yard with lots of air and sunshine and water, we still can't get it to grow. And I think sometimes, I think people take for granted how hard it is to get something to grow. And then if we really are going to have a civilization here in the United States, especially that's going to survive off what we grow, we got to get it exactly right. And not just this year, but, you know, for like a couple hundred years to come, if we want to keep this thing going.
Yeah, we've got to get it right for the long run. And, you know, I'm amazed at the productivity of both ancient and modern farmers, and as well as what my wife can grow in the garden, because, you know, personally, I have a brown thumb. I can't grow anything. But the idea that we've pursued over the last, for an awful long time as a species, is to take a limited number of tools that we have, the plow, you know, worked all the way up to now modern fertilizers, and we apply them everywhere in sort of the same way. We don't tend to try and tailor how we farm and what we do to the land to the way that soils are different in different parts of the landscape, the way that you can grow different things in different areas. And one of the big challenges I see for the long run is to try and learn how to actually tailor how we garden the planet, to use the sort of the broad definition of gardening to encompass farming in a way that reinvests in the soil so that future generations can grow at least as much as we're growing now, because they'll need to.
I'll go back again with some history questions in a second, but as long as you've touched on it, who's the worst exploiters of their soil? What nation has the reputation, at least, for being the people who are burning through their soil the fastest? Because if it's a large nation like Russia or China, they got a lot of people and they won't have a lot of food, and that's going to spell trouble, judging by history.
Well, you know, if you look at simply at judging it by erosion rates today, the place that's falling apart the fastest is part of China. It's off the Liss Plateau, where the erosion rates are just they're literally unbelievable.
Explain what that means. So, like, what's a good erosion rate and what's a disastrous one?
Well, you know, if you take sort of a the strict perspective of a geologist that sort of says, okay, if we're going to keep farming this piece of land, we need to lose the soil no faster than it's being reformed, then a fast rate is anything more than like a tenth of a millimeter a year, which is not very fast. I mean, your fingernails grow an awful lot faster than that. But if you look in terms of sort of catastrophic erosion rates where you could lose the whole soil over just a few generations, you know, if you're losing millimeters a year, they can add up pretty fast, because it only takes 25 millimeters to make an inch, and if there's only 6 inches of topsoil, then what, that's about 150 years at that kind of a rate. I mean, it can go pretty fast in just centuries if it's eroding, you know, north of a few millimeters a year. But there's places in off the Liss Plateau in China that are eroding a lot faster than that, where the water is just sort of brown. Now, part of it is the geologic setting. I mean, it naturally erodes pretty fast. But
because of the steppes, you mean?
Yeah, because if you take a Liss, it's a really fragile kind of soil. It doesn't, it's easy to erode. If you took a garden hose to it and sprayed it, it would just, like, you know, it'd just run right off.
Right.
And so if you stick it on the margin of the Tibetan Plateau where it's fairly steep, so you've got steep slopes and you've got very fragile soil, and then you have a monsoon on top of it, it's a recipe for a lot of erosion.
So after that, then, if they lose that topsoil, then it's either hydroponics or missiles, pretty much, isn't it?
the problem with missiles is obvious, but the problem with hydroponics is that it takes an awful lot of energy to grow stuff hydroponically. You've got to bring the nutrients to the soil rather than letting sort of soil ecology and microbes do it for you.
That's not good. Okay, so China would be the one that we might run out of soil faster than we would.
Well, yeah, China is a worry. But if you look at the U.S., we're actually pretty well positioned globally in this whole soil problem, and it's for a couple reasons. One is that the American Midwest has an amazing amount of loess soil in it. We've burned through an awful lot of the topsoil in the Midwest over the long run, but it is possible to actually rebuild rich, fertile topsoil, and it's a lot easier to remix organic matter into loess than it is to turn rocks into loess in the first place.
Well, explain that word for people, loess.
Oh, loess. Loess is essentially, it's silt. So it's a fairly fine soil. It's fairly clean. Doesn't have a lot of rocks in it. It's and what it is it's wind deposited soil. So if you think about what happened to all the dirt that got scraped off of Canada in the last ice age, it got bulldozed down into the northern part of the Midwest, and then it blew around for thousands of years, and it piled up in great drifts that form deposits that technically aren't soil. But it's silt. It can become very good agricultural soil. And we have a lot of it in the Midwest. There's
Isn't
places
it good,
where...
Uh-huh, go ahead. Excuse me? No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I thought you were done. Go ahead.
Oh,
in places
where we have an awful lot of loess soil that we can use. We could actually mine it over the long run. We shouldn't, because we will eventually run out if we do. But we have a fairly large supply of it, whereas there's other parts of the world, particularly in the tropics, where they don't have that luxury. They essentially, once they burn through the thin layer of topsoil on top of rock, they've got to wait until that you make new soil from the rock to actually have more soil, and that just takes longer than is relevant for human societies.
Doesn't that take millions of years?
Well, it takes thousands of years.
Okay, thousands.
Which, you know, in terms of the longevity of a human society, it's almost as good as millions of years.
Yeah, might as well be. it's a good thing then that we have so many lawns? Because by having healthy lawns, doesn't that sort of seal the deal and keep the soil where it's supposed to be?
Well, you know, keeping vegetation on soil is one of the best ways to keep the soil in place.
Right.
But there's really two aspects to soil fertility. One is having the soil there at all, and that's where the erosion problem comes in, because once you erode it all, it's obviously not very fertile.
Right.
But then in maintaining soil fertility, that's a whole nother area and issue. And so how we actually treat lawns is a good way, is an indicator of what it can mean for soil fertility over the long run. We used to have a lawn in our yard that was just had horrendously nasty soil in it. There's not a living thing in it. It had been a lawn that had been there for almost 100 years. And it was just a tangle of roots above bare, dead soil, in effect. And we essentially restored the soil under our lawn by changing the lawn and treating it differently, putting different plants in it, so that instead of sort of a single instead of a Kentucky bluegrass lawn, there's now four different kind of plants, two forbs and two kinds of clover and two kinds of grass. And we just mow it back, and we just let the clippings sit on the lawn.
Right.
And what I was amazed by is not that how nicely that saves me a whole lot of work, but that the worms take the grass back down into the soil. And we've actually increased the carbon content of the soil underneath our lawn dramatically in just about 8 years. So we're actually, tempted to do a carbon budget for our yard because we think we've turned our lawn into something that was, you know, just nice to play with the dog on into something that's actually functioning as a carbon sink.
Does that mean that in order to keep a healthy soil layer, we should be burying more people outside? I mean that. I mean, where we return carbon to carbon, I mean, would that help or does that not help? I mean, is your,
well,
if you're talking...
Volumetrically, I think that there's I haven't looked at the numbers, but there's an awful lot of the world's there's an awful lot of carbon in people, and the idea that you would sequester that in the long run might be a good one. The idea of returning organic matter to the soil is an excellent one, and I'll just avoid the issue of whether how we should bury people.
I'm fascinated.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of...
No, I'm not going to let you off the hook. Because
I
think that...
Then I'll answer for myself. When I die, I don't want to be embalmed. I don't want to be cremated. I'd like to be put back in the ground so I can return to the soil. I mean, it's in a way, it's a reinvestment in life. And I think that's what we should be doing, but I don't want to tell people how to deal
well,
with it.
But I'm telling you, there's that whole movement, right, of outdoor burials where they're putting off areas and so that people can just naturally go back to, you know, from dust to dust, you know, ashes to ashes. And I think that there's also something about for an area, I was just curious whether if there was an area where they were having trouble with their soil, could that be a national effort by some countries to start doing more open air burials so that they were more inclined to be able to get more, I mean, sorry, but to get more worms and to get more activity going underneath the soil so they get you know, they'd be able to sustain their future after all.
You could make that argument as a long-term argument. There might be, I don't know enough about the public health issues that would be involved to know whether or not there would be a substantial time delay before you could actually use that soil.
Right.
But in terms of a long-term intergenerational investment, the argument's hard to argue with.
Right. No, I'm just curious.
What we could do, though, is that we could put other kinds of organic matter back into our agricultural soils with much more immediate effects in ways that are not only feasible, but they're profitable.
Are we talking about composting, then?
Yeah, essentially composting no-till agriculture, composting, and the idea of biochar, the idea of putting charcoal back into soils to increase soil organic matter and so it will help it hold water and also sequester carbon. You know, it's sort of the inverse of the idea of cutting carbon emissions down by changing cars and fuel sources and things like that. We can also stash carbon in the soil. As a way to actually help address the problem of global warming.
I have a fireplace on my porch, and I burn a cord or two of wood every winter out on the porch. And then come spring, I've got these big buckets of ash that I've been piling up all winter long. What can I do with that wood and paper ash? That helps seal in the moisture. Is that what you said?
Charcoal can ash. If it's clean ashes, there aren't sort of other kind of chemical issues with it. Merging that back in the soil is a way to actually return some of the nutrients to the ground.
So do I put that like in a seed spreader or something and take it over my lawn in the spring? Or can I put it in? I mean, I'd be afraid of putting too much of it in any one place, but I mean, I've got lots of ash, so I mean,
you got a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, tell me what I've always been curious about that because
I would have to consult with my wife on that one because she's the one who has all the experience on sort of the tricks of gardening. My suspicion is that there's certain kinds of plants that would do really well with a lot of the ash and certain plants that would not.
Let me know.
Yeah.
All right. So but we were talking about the Civil War, and we were talking about how civilizations have been formed by erosion and by changes in the soil. we were talking about how the early colonies were certainly shaped by that, because tobacco was such a good crop, a good cash crop for the investors. But even really, I mean, even the idea of moving to the New World was shaped by problems with the soil. I mean, even the potato famine, right, and other things that happened that got people to say, I think I'll move to where the dirt is.
Yeah, there was. You could think of the thing that Europe had in the.
For chapter three here, so I think it's chapter three. I thought it was interesting the idea of the Western movement as a result of how sort of European outlooks on soil had changed. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, you know, the Europeans had essentially run out of vacant land by about, right, you know, the late 1700s, about the time that the push to the New World, to North America, became a viable one. And the there were changes in the way the Europeans were managing their land that arose from how they looked at soil and soil fertility. They were starting to realize that if they just sort of continually had the same crops on the same piece of ground over and over again, they would eventually exhaust the soil. So they started getting into things like crop rotation and what they called soil husbandry, looking at the way you could take care of the soil over the long run and reinvest in the nutrients in it. And it turned out that a big part of what they did is they then started fencing in the commons, and so that you could have adopted the philosophy that if you needed livestock manure to essentially generate the manure to put back on fields, and so that you would rotate. You'd grow crops in a field for a while, then you'd put your livestock on it and move stuff around. What that did is it led to larger ownerships, estates. And so a lot of the peasantry in Europe were essentially kicked out of their ancestral lands and driven into cities right at about the time that the Industrial Revolution set up the need for cheap labor in cities to run factories. But what that also meant was that there wasn't a lot of land for the lower classes. And so going to the New World was a way to get to new land. Because in the New World, land was cheap, labor was expensive, and it was the inverse in Europe.
But it was fresh soil, too. So it was sort of like a whole new start on what to do with the soil. And I thought that was an interesting movement. I don't really think of it in those terms. I know about the idea about owning land, but the quality of the land was something else again, too. And that was part of the prosperity, part of the promise. Historically speaking, I heard something the other day I thought was interesting, that perhaps the reason why hunter-gatherers decided to stop moving around was the need to grow crops so that they could have beer. Have you ever heard that before?
Well, you know, geologists love beer, so, you know, it's a wonderful theory.
But you're all for it.
Yeah, if you actually look at the time that agriculture evolved, it was long before beer.
Okay. All right.
It was essentially at the end of if you look back at sort of where agriculture evolved in the Western world, it was up in the Zagros Mountains, part of Iraq, Iran region today. And there was a cold snap called the Younger Dryas period, where coming out of the Ice Age, the climate was warming up, and then it reverted back to cold for a while. And the food sources for hunter-gatherers in that region essentially shifted really radically, really fast. They were sort of on the edge where the environmental change was really high. And the earliest evidence that I know of for sort of the adoption of agriculture is right in that area where they're really hit hard. And so the case that I think holds pretty well is that people started agriculture out of desperation. They're trying to feed themselves.
They move from like a protein diet to a carbon diet, like a carbohydrate diet.
Yeah, and what they found was that as they learned how to farm in that region and got good at it, they could actually support more people. So their population density started to rise to a level that they couldn't support themselves in the old way anymore.
Is it, and we have about 30 seconds for this answer, is it true that the Western United States is covered with soil that originated in China?
Kind of. We do get dust that blows in from China, but most of the soil in the Western U.S. came from the rocks underneath the Western U.S.
Okay.
With a light dusting of Chinese soil on top.
All right. Then I want to ask you, where, if China is the country where soil is eroding the fastest and eroding in such an alarming way that they may not even have topsoil in some large parts that are currently feeding the Chinese right now, where is that soil going? Hang on for that. We'll get to the answer from Dirt, the erosion of civilizations. We'll talk about our future a little bit more. What do we have to know? What do we learn from history and how other people have treated their dirt? Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.